Working Cows Podcast, episode 155.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Howdy, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows podcast, here with another episode for you. Really excited to be joined today by Justin Rader. Justin is one of the guys, one of the folks behind 100th Meridian Ranching in Canadian, Texas, and he is here today to talk to us about bull leasing. They are sending bulls all over the country, and he's going to tell us about why it's something that we should consider as an option when we are looking at how we are going to improve our herd, genetically speaking, and some of the advantages that come along with bull leasing. So good discussion up today. Really looking forward to talking to Justin Rader of 100th Meridian Ranching about bull leasing. Justin, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows podcast.
You bet, Clay. Glad to be here. This is fun.
So you are running a little bit different seed stock operation in that you guys are doing a lot of bull leasing. Can you talk about some of the ways that that's different from the typical paradigm of owning bulls or, you know, somebody maybe even raising their own bulls, but what's different about what you guys are doing as far as leasing bulls and how do those arrangements work typically in the spot that you guys are in?
Sure. So in general, the bull leasing thing is one part of our whole ranch as far as one enterprise. And I can get excited about it because I can believe that it solves problems for people. So like just our background of being involved in the cow-calf side of it, you got these dang bulls around. And they're bulls. They do things bulls do. And they always kind of felt like a problem when we weren't using them, and even when we were using them. So just thinking of that and then just learning from other people who are doing it, we're by no means any pioneer on the idea, but we are trying to do it well and serve people that way. So the idea is that we can take that bull who's underutilized for a lot of times, 9 months out of the year, and get them used for multiple people at beneficial times that fit their calving season and their need and the type of bull they want. We can turn that bull from a problem into an asset. And so I felt like on our place, at least, that was just kind of one of our most wasted areas. You know, when you drive out into the bull pasture and you see a number of bulls standing there, you could look at that one way and say, oh, that's a lot of genetic power out there. But you could look at it the other way and say, man, that's a lot of maintenance costs. That's a lot of crippled bulls. That's a lot of, you know, broken fence and neighbor's fence that it was bulls tear down and stuff like that. So that was kind of the background of it. And it's been fun to get around the country and meet people and hopefully solve some problems for them by bringing a bull when they need it.
And if I understand your location, you're kind of in the northwest corner of the Texas Panhandle. Is that right?
Yeah, the northeast corner, northeast corner. So, okay. Yeah, just right along the 100th Meridian.
So my dad always says he wishes there was a shot that he could give a bull in the spring or, you know, in the late summer, I guess, that would put it to sleep until the early summer the next year. And I guess that's kind of what bull leasing is. Bulls tend to break each other and break other stuff. So what are you guys, are you using bulls, you said, multiple times of the year? Is it fall and spring, the fall calving and the spring calving guys, or is it early spring and summer calvers? How does that work for you guys?
Yeah, I'd say any or all, really. It seems like we got a lot of bulls out from, say, April to August timeframe, April to now. And then a lot of bulls out Thanksgiving to, you know, New Year's timeframe. And then some summer calvers too. So just having that kind of a group of different people in different areas is one of the things that keeps our deal flowing and keeps those rascals busy for the different calving season. So it really is a mix of all of it, I'd say.
Can a bull go from one guy's place in an early spring breeding to another guy's place in a late summer breeding? Will they hold up to that kind of use, or is it, do you guys have to kind of pay attention to the way the bulls are performing throughout the year?
Yeah, I'd say we'd have to pay attention for sure. But that question or that challenge has kind of like driven us to the really thick bulls from breeders who are tougher on them and who breed them to work, rather than the fat show calf kind of feedlot bull that you see in a lot of magazines. So just picking bulls that are not developed enough, but just have the hustle and get up and go. Seems like, not only is their longevity longer, but their like usability within the year is longer too. So I think it's possible to have them. Well, I think we underestimate them a lot is what I'm trying to say, I guess. But the right kind of bulls really do matter on their usefulness.
Yeah, and I think there's probably a paradigm that says, 25 cows to a bull. And if we really paid attention and did some parentage testing, you'd find out that you've got one bull that's covering 10 cows and another one that's covering 30 or 40 cows, and if you started to select bulls more like the one that's covering 40 cows, you might not need as many bulls around as you think. Is that kind of line up with what you guys are finding out?
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that theory. We did kind of an experiment this summer with a customer in Kansas where we turned out one bull per 100 heifers. I think it was 30 or 45 days, and so they haven't preg checked them yet, but it's kind of exciting to see what the result of that is. So those bulls definitely got a lot of work in that short amount of time, and it drew them down some, but that's kind of the upper extremity of what I thought we'd ever tried. They were all game for it, and it's kind of an interesting experiment.
Definitely going to find the most fertile heifers in that group.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
So what is kind of some of the bottom line things that you see as far as the economic side of leasing bulls for people who are thinking about it or people who are already doing it?
Yeah. So, for a number of years, I operated like they teach you in colleges. You go to the bull sales and you pay a little over average price for good bulls and take them home and you use them for 4 years. Then you can them. So if I've made some economic models showing that, like, I really think you could easily have $1,200 in owning a bull and using him and salvaging over his lifetime there. So when you lease a bull for $1,000, you're automatically $200 a bull ahead, just on the cash to cash comparison there. So, I think when you add that $200 ahead savings, and I tried to model those as apples to apples. So I said, what if you got a $3,000 bull compared to a $3,000 bull, or a $6,000 bull compared to a $6,000 bull? They cost you a lot of money. And leasing always takes a little bit less, it seems, if I'm doing my job for my customer. So when you add on that couple hundred dollars savings, plus not having around for 9 months of the year, plus not having the broken stuff torn up, plus the minimized risk of, if there is a problem with the bull, it's not the customer's problem. It's my problem. So we tried to structure this deal where it's, taking all those risks and all those hassles off of our customers' plates and realizing that they're in the cow-calf production business and not the bull handling business so much. And just the ultimate goal is to get their cows bred with a good bull. Not deal with all the stuff that comes with bulls. So,
and what do you see as maybe some of the other or unforeseen costs of having bulls around? And here I'm kind of thinking of feed, but maybe there's other things that are unforeseen costs that might free up some capital that could be used another way.
Yeah. So, like if you said you were going to go to a sale and buy four bulls, say they were, $4,000 bulls, you're going to spend $6,000 on them, $16,000. Versus if you lease those four bulls for $4,000 total, you're talking about saving $12,000 in cash, cash that you would have flowed somewhere. So you could flow it into that bull who's going to be standing out there, or you could flow it into ranch projects, infrastructure, paying down debt, family vacation, whatever it would be. That cash flow is worth a lot. Just that number of dollars standing there, I think cost us a lot more than we realize. You know, everybody's got a bull, quote, bull pasture. It's grass that's out there too that they're standing around on for 9 months. If you said a bull was 1.5 times the animal units of a cow, you got rid of those guys for 9 months, I really think a lot of ranches could be running an extra 5% more cows just by replacing cows with bulls that the bulls actually leave with the lease program. So I'm not an ag economist, but more income for more cows is usually a good thing.
Yeah.
For the ranch bottom line.
Yeah, it does. That was an interesting piece for me is that, 9 months of the year that bull isn't standing around out there. And then also the increased carrying capacity for cows that are going to give you a calf, that's a pretty interesting thing to think about for sure.
You bet.
It's worth the consideration anyways.
Yes. I've made the mistake of like going to a bull sale before where you kind of get caught up in the heat of the auction moment and you overbid a bull that you weren't planning on spending that much more on. And so I shot my bull budget a time or two by overbidding things. But that's one of the things about just having a firm, fair set price on a lease is you can kind of look at your numbers and say, hey, I think I need 4 or 5 or 10 bulls this year. Here's the price of what they're going to cost. And there's no upside surprises on that. So I think that's one of the things we're seeing some people use is just it helps you budget farther out. Cause you never know what a sale is going to average until it's over with. And I hate to run my business that way, kind of looking in the rear view, cost wise.
Yeah. It's a firm cost you can count on, we hope it stays under this cost that you have to go and live with what you can get for that amount of money.
You bet.
It seems like a lot of times you go to a bull sale and there's more grass on the prairie than there's more money to be spent on bulls. And that can be a hard thing to deal with when the average price is a lot higher this year than it was last year. And so you guys maybe aren't going to have a lower lease on a lower grass year, but you're probably not going to have a lot higher lease on a higher grass year either. So it kind of takes those fluctuations out of that market too. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I'd say so. You know, it's just the more things we can lock in at a reasonable cost, I think the better we are for budgeting projections. And I've never sat in one of these, ranching meetings where people said, but we're just facing huge problems because we're way under budget. You know, it's usually the other way around. And this could just be a tool for the flexibility and the ability to lock that, you know, lease price in and say, hey, this is what we're counting on bulls for the year. And then it's just that.
We did talk a little bit about the health side of keeping bulls around all year. What are some of the things that you guys have thought of as this is a problem we're trying to solve in that risk mitigation or convenience kind of idea of this practice?
Yeah. So the number one, you know, question that people ask me a lot of times is what about the health or what about disease issues with these bulls? And so our program is that we will bring you a good trick and semen tested bull with all of his appropriate vaccines administered beforehand and let you use them for the breeding season as long as you bring a good trick and semen tested bull back. So we essentially trick semen test into and out of every herd. That could be a killer for anybody and nobody wants to deal with it. So, even though these bulls are getting used a lot, they're getting tested a lot too. And that testing and the negative trick test there, that's what allows me to sleep at night on that risk dealing with the trick. our goal, you know, once again, is just to get keep people's cows bred. And so that's one thing we don't take any extra risks on or can't afford to ignore. So, you know, as far as the bull's physical health himself, we have vets do it in and out. It's not our opinions. So we just trust those professionals to provide us with their advice and their recommendations on if a bull is crippled, well, how crippled is he? And we don't want that to ever be a problem. So we trust their breeding soundness exams to say, yep, he's good to go, or nope, we better pull it back and bring you another bull. So just that health wise, yeah, there is some risk out there, but I think we're doing all the things we can do to mitigate that risk as far as bringing anything in or out of a herd.
Is trick a widely spread issue? Is that something that you guys have had to deal with, or have you guys been able to see bulls go out healthy and come back healthy?
Yeah, we've been able to see them come in healthy and go out. We've never had a trick positive. As far as I know, neither vet that we use here in the county have seen a trick positive either. At least here. So we're really fortunate that way. And, you know, we have a part of our agreement says, you know, if a bull does get tricked on your place, he's your bull for a pre-agreed upon price. And so, you know, by having that, I thought maybe we can have the lessee take some responsibility or have some skin in the game to say, hey, I'm confident enough in my cow herd. You know, I haven't noticed any problems as far as calving percentages or anything, that they're willing to partner with us on that risk. And so it's a long way of saying the people that are interested in these bulls are good producers and not the high risk kind of trader sale barn type of cows that you would worry about as far as disease issues.
What are some of the other ideas from a convenience standpoint that you guys have seen or that you guys have been looking at as some of the problems that you guys are trying to solve?
The biggest one is just having that bull gone for 9 months of the year. You know, if he's gone 75% of the time, your risk of him jumping onto the neighbor's heifers are 75% reduced. That's a good thing. As far as convenience as well, like, you know, if a producer doesn't like a certain bull or has a problem, we'll bring him a replacement. It's a lot different scenario leasing a bull and having a 3 month commitment rather than owning one and having a 4 or 5 year commitment. You know, if you accidentally bought the wrong bull at the sale, you're almost stuck with him in a way unless you can peddle him off or trade him somehow. So it's just that commitment. You're able to shift and change quickly. If, say 1 year, you kept back double the amount of heifers you normally do. I've only been ranching a while, but never seen a year that was the same. You know, so some years you might need heifer bulls. Some years you might need cow bulls. Some years you might need Charolais bulls. Or, you know, if you just change your mind and you got a complicated three herd breeding system going on. And this year you put a heifer bull on a black cow and you created black baldies, but then you need a Charolais terminal. You know, this leasing thing takes out a lot of complications of having to own a certain type of bull for a long time. And I think kind of enables you to tailor, you know, the type or the breed of bull that you're trying to target as far as a calf crop.
That's the flexibility is a big deal. You know, like you're talking about being able to switch even breeds of bulls, you know, and so I guess maybe get that out there too. What breeds of bulls are you guys currently leasing?
Yeah. Most of our bulls are Black Angus, Red Angus, and Charolais. It seems like demand-wise, those are kind of all in equal demand. And, you know, some of our customers who wanted a black bull last year want a Charolais this year, and vice versa. Just being able to serve their differing needs has been interesting. So, you know, within our black bulls, we've got kind of moderate to low input kind of bulls. A lot of those are heifer bulls, and then we got more the terminal kind of growthy black bulls. And so, you know, within the three breeds, there's different types of bulls as well. I'm calling the Charolais just all Charolais. I'm never going to promote a Charolais as a heifer bull, even though they might have good numbers. It's kind of like selling a kid horse, and then I'm leery of doing any of those things. So
yeah, no, I appreciate that you distinguish the maternal from the terminal, even within the Black Angus and a Black Angus bull on a Black Angus cow. I think that's a lot of what we see going on in the industry. And I asked Burke Tigard about it when I interviewed him. I said, do you think that most of the bulls that people are using, even Black Angus on Black Angus, is actually a terminal bull? And he said, yeah, I do. I think they grow too big, too fast to make a good cow, produce a good replacement female. And I think that's a lot of the problem that we see in this industry is there's too many cows that have been turned into cows that probably should have been, you know, a terminal female that just should have gone into the grow yard and never made it into a breeding herd.
You bet. Personally, I've got my own theories on what types of animals we ought to be growing, and I lean towards those more moderate, low-input kind of cows with the growthier bull put on them. So I'm not trying to change anybody's mind. It's hard to change people's minds, I think. But we'll give them kind of a sampler platter of, do they want to try a bull like that for 1 year, see what kind of females they get out of them, and then maybe over time, they'll feel more comfortable with the idea or a certain breeder and gravitate that direction rather than just kind of being stuck in your rut and saying, this is how I breed them. This is how I breed them. So it's been fun to kind of have a different assortment of bulls and understand people's different ranches and different, you know, heck, even personal and family situations that play into their decisions of what kind of bulls they want.
Like AIing is even more extenuated where you've only got those bulls out there for 30 or 60 days, you know, so you've got them standing around for 11 months or 10 months instead. You know, if somebody's AIing a bunch of cows, I know a couple of different places around here that AI every cow and then turn a bull out later, you know, so I think that's another interesting way to think about it is in a lease scenario, that might even be another reason to think about it.
Yeah, you bet. Like just this year, for example, we had some customers, AI heifers, and they wanted heifer bulls for the cleanup bulls, which was great and got them covered. I've got another customer who AIs all of his cows, but with a black bull. So he wanted a bull of a different color so he could tell his AI bulls mm-hmm. from his cow bred bull. So he'll have a bunch of AI black babies coming in the spring, followed by a jag of smoky babies in the spring. He said, you know, that's just another way to simplify my operation is when I go off of the wheat pasture, I don't have to look through my records and say, well, that tag out of such and such mm-hmm. cow, I can look and say, hey, here's my black replacements and here's my smoky terminals.
Yep.
And so it just simplified his life.
Yep. That's exactly what I wanted to do this year, but I couldn't find or didn't find early enough a place to lease a Charlet bull.
You bet.
There's always next year, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
I think I my wife and I come from a little bit different backgrounds, and I kind of come from a background of you never turn your back on a bull. You always are kind of out of the corner of your eye watching where that bull is in the pen. And she comes from the background of the Simmental bull that stood next to the back fence of her yard, and they'd reach over with the yard rake and scratch its back. And, you know, so I think there's probably a range of bull dispositions out there. But could you talk a little bit about some of the benefits as far as you guys and the way that you guys are handling these bulls and the way that they are to be around?
Yeah, you bet. We want our bulls to be easy to handle. On day one and on day 90. So just the nature of our business, we handle them a lot and the nature of our grazing as well. So when we move them, you know, throughout the grazing season, you can see them a lot and handle them. And that lets, if there is bad apples, it lets them show up and we do our best to call on disposition a lot. Even if, you know, there's nothing wrong with them phenotypically, we want the gentle, easy to handle bulls to go out to lease less ease. And just on our end risk, but on their end, it's just being friends and neighbors is just wanting them to have a pleasant experience with them, and not getting hurt. I'm like you. I don't trust any of them. You know, I don't have my pepper spray on the ready all the time either. so just smart animal handling, I think, is the key there.
Right.
But hopefully, you know, that was some of the problems I had with buying bulls from some places is you buy them one day in the auction, you've only been around them an hour.
Right.
And then he turns out to be a hard to handle one. Whereas we kind of live with them and handle them. They do show up and we hope we can kind of continue to weed out the harder to handle ones and keep propagating the easy to handle ones. So just a surprise that kind of showed up to me. And bulls change over time too. You know, on certain days they have bad days and certain days we have bad days, but it seems like as they get older, they do get a little tougher to handle. And so that's another reason we just quicker turnover within our bull age and some bulls, helps somewhat with that.
Isn't it interesting that their bad days and our bad days coincide almost like maybe they're related?
Yeah. I don't know. There's a lot going in there. I can't explain.
Yeah. Do you guys have to be the only source of bulls for a herd, or can your bulls go into a herd that's as a supplement to somebody else's bull program?
I think we'd be willing to go into a supplement situation as long as we knew some information about the herd and those other bulls. You know, there's just all these scenarios that kind of keep popping up as we get into it a little longer, but it just kind of would go back to our risk thing with Trick is
right.
We want to make sure that their cows get bred and stay bred. If it's an unknown deal, I'm a little leery of it. But if it's more of a known deal and the producer's happy with it and you know can accept the terms of the agreement and take his own part of the risk, as far as a partnership deal, I'd generally go with their gut too. But we don't want to be foolish either.
Where are you guys getting your bulls? What is kind of the genetic pool that you guys are drawing from, as far as bulls and some of those things? What can people expect if they're coming to 100 Meridian Ranching to get their bulls?
Yeah. So we want our bulls to be kind of quality that you would recognize a name of. So either bloodline wise or breeder wise. And so we've got bulls from Faro Cattle Company, Jorgensen Angus, the Bradley B3 Ranch, Little Robe Angus, Fast Herefords, Indian Mound Herefords, just kind of reputable breeders that we feel like are kind of have the same goals in mind as we do. People that are honest and fair and do a good job with their breeding. So that's kind of been our source. And I like that idea. You know, I've kind of considered like, am I competing with the breeder? And I don't want that to be. So what I'm hoping we're doing is giving a cow-calf producer a chance to try a Hereford bull if he's never tried a bull, or try a Black Angus bull if he's never tried a bull from a certain breeder.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, promote that breeder's reputation and bloodline too. Because some of these bulls we've got are kind of cost prohibitive for the average cow-calf producer to go out and buy a bull at X dollars just to try for 1 year. So this leasing thing kind of opens up that chance in a way. And I kind of get excited about that. Yeah. So we hope we're kind of paying homage to our sources of breeders, and then getting them a little more exposure at the same time.
I have one of my favorite quotes that I've been repeating often lately, is when it works, it's called line breeding. When it doesn't, it's called inbreeding. So, how are you guys, helping people manage kind of that genetic diversity within their herds?
Yeah, you bet. And so just having having three breeds, on top of having different types of bulls within the three breeds helps us. You know, one of the things a lot of people worry about is they've got a favorite bull that they really like, and they've kept several daughters out of him for a number of years now. You know, coming up on year two or three, he's got a chance to be breeding his own daughters, and that inbreeding risk there is a risk of some sort. So by being able to swap him out or shuffle him to a different pasture or have those females out of him bred to a different bull, kind of takes that risk away from them and still lets them kind of propagate that line that they like without the inbreeding, you know, scenario happening as likely. So that's been a lot of the driver for people swapping out bulls.
What's kind of your turnaround time? Somebody hears this episode and, you know, these episodes will get downloaded for years from now. So somebody hears this episode at some point prior to their breeding season and they're like, well, I think that's worth a shot. What do you think? What's kind of your turnaround time as far as them getting in touch with you guys and then having a bull show up on their doorstep?
Yeah. So my dream would be to be the Uber of bulls. My wife and I used Uber on a trip a few years ago, and I was just blown away. You know, when you can stand on the street corner and hit the button, and there's a car that pulls up in 3 minutes to take you somewhere. So that's be our dream. We're working towards that slowly. But as far as turnaround time, that I'm learning that the scheduling is the trickier part than actually managing the bull. So the right bull for the right person at the right time is the challenge. And the more heads up a person can give us, the better off we'll be able to fill their order. It's really tough when somebody calls us, hey, I need 10 polled Hereford bulls with a such and such EPD, and I need them next week. It's really hard to fill a specific order that quickly. But if you gave me a year's heads up on that, that's no problem, or even a few months.
Yep.
So, you know, breeding season to some people seems like a surprise, but it happens every year, kind of like clockwork. And, so that's one of our things is that the more heads up you could give us, the better job we can do filling your order to the details you'd like as far as getting everything organized.
So you're there in Canadian, Texas, it says, and you're just, you said just west of the 100th Meridian, and the name of your ranch is 100th Meridian Ranching. Could you tell me a little bit about what that means to you and kind of what you guys are kind of the ethos of 100th Meridian Ranching?
Yeah. My wife, Brynn, and I both grew up on family ranches and just love the heritage that experience gave us. But we both kind of had a desire to create our own ranch or outfit in a way, too. So we're very thankful for the heritage for those ranching, you know, families on each side of our marriage. But to do our justice to our dream too, we felt like we had to work on building the future. So, a few years ago, I read that book called Ranching West of the 100th Meridian. And, you know, our ancestors, a lot of them came from either Tennessee or Germany or someplace like that. They always had kind of the 100th Meridian in mind. Just once they crossed it and got into Texas, or at least the ones here that we ended up descending from, they stopped and they set up little farms or little ranches. And that's kind of the family heritage that we've gotten. So I was thankful to have a chance to tie that to our family ties, but, you know, just our geographic location kind of give a regional feel to it as well, as far as the name. But, in that book, Ranching West of the 100th Meridian, one of the authors, Bob Budd, wrote one of the best things I've been challenged with. It was when he said he was talking about raising his kids on a ranch. And now that we've got a kiddo and one on the way, it makes me look at it differently than I did as an old bachelor. So he said, you know, he was talking about his kids and all the experiences they had. And he said, am I teaching my children to love something they can never have? And I thought, man, if I've got to answer that for the question for myself, that's a challenging question to answer, just given all the threats that are against modern ranching now. And so it kind of forced me to internally dig down and say, man, am I doing the best thing I can with what I've got right now to give our boys a future and give them as many good options as possible, whether they want to come back to the ranch or not. I feel like I got a big responsibility just to steward the things we've been blessed with. So I just want to make myself not get into a place where I'm comfortable, not pushing and not trying and not giving them every opportunity I can. So that was kind of an inspiration from that book.
Is the answer to that question more often yes, if the ranch is, or if the rancher is looking at his responsibility primarily as one of a steward of resources and trying to improve those resources in your mind, or does it truly just depend? Sometimes the answer to that is going to be no, even though I did everything I could.
Yeah, that's hard to answer. I think some ranches may have a bad hand dealt to them and just really tough challenges to overcome. But it kind of goes back to, do you see yourself as the chicken or the fox? I think personally is, you know, what kind of drive do you have to make things work in a tough economic time, or how committed to you are, you know, under this rural lifestyle idea? And then what are you willing to do about it? You know, I felt like for a while I wasn't sure if I wanted to come back and ranch, but I remember hearing some talks at a symposium one day, walking out of those and thinking, man, I don't care how hard I've got to work. I don't care what it takes. I know I want to be a rancher after hearing these things. And so that was kind of a turning point for me where I felt like, gosh, I'd be a fool to turn this opportunity down. So, and I don't know if that's the same way for everybody, but that's probably what would be true for us.
Was that kind of the shift for you from being involved at that level to be involved at a management level, or was it not involved at all to being involved on some level when that shift happened for you?
All I can really say is, like, personally, I kind of saw, you know, transitions of those things. You know, for a while in your life, you're okay with one, and then you kind of have a desire for the next. It's hard to answer that in competent words, I would suppose. I don't know if people are born with that or develop that, but I do feel like this is kind of my calling, in a way, to encourage people in agriculture. And I felt like, because it's tough, there's some really tough days. And so when I come in at the end of the day and I'm discouraged or I had a bad day, my wife's really good about encouraging me and getting me back on track. So in a way, we want to do that for other people in ag, especially young people, because there are a multitude of challenges. And so to answer your question, I would say, like, we felt like maybe the best way we could help encourage people is to try to live it and put our money where our mouth is and just ranch professionally, full time, whatever you want to say, and hopefully help people along the way.
Very good. I guess maybe the best way to ask the question I've been dancing around is what are you and your wife doing to make sure that the answer to that question is yes, that I'm not teaching my kids to love something they can never have. How do you look at that as we're doing everything we can, or what are some of the things that you are doing to make sure that they do have that opportunity if they want to be involved at that level?
One of the things that's helped us the most is, you know, regular college and stuff's fine, but after going through that and then some real life ups and downs, going back to the ranching for profit school and joining the EL was one of those things, but just a game changer for us, that as far as surrounding yourselves with positive people and who push you to be the best you can be. And that's one of the things we're doing. And so, you know, there's not a day go by that I think about some part of that as far as our personal life or business life. And I hope that's wearing off on our kiddos, being positive there for them.
Just is very good stuff. How can people get a hold of you if they want to be involved, if they want to get a hold of you guys to bring in some bulls next year, or maybe even for a fall calving scenario coming up? How could people get a hold of you to look at the options that they might have available to them if they want to use some 100th Meridian Ranching bulls?
Sure. Well, our website is 100thMeridianRanching.com. It's 100th MeridianRanching.com. And there's a tab to our bull leasing thing on there, as well as a sub tab to click on to see our bull lease agreement. My cell phone's 806-255-3046. And my email is just my name, justin.d.rader@gmail.com.
Very good. Appreciate the time today. And links to all that will be in the show notes page at workingcows.net/155, workingcows.net/155. There's a show notes page for today, and there'll be links to 100th Meridian Ranching and the book that he mentioned. Looks like there's still some copies available if you want to go out and get one. So if I haven't left too many major things on the table, you've got a really nice website, and under the About section, you've got some headings there that probably could be a whole episode in themselves. So maybe we'll have to get back together sometime and talk about your commitment to small communities and some of those things.
All right. Thanks, Clay. That'd be great. We appreciate you and your work that you're doing.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks for your time today.
You bet. Bye.
Very good. Very good. Really appreciate Justin's time again, and look forward to further conversations with him. And coming up next week, really excited to be joined again by Dallas Mount, now the owner of Ranch Management Consultants, the folks behind the Ranching for Profit School. And we're going to be talking to him about how to handle difficult conversations. So tune in next week for another episode of the Working Cows podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.